What I would ask you to do through my presentation is please, in your own mind, reflect on your encounters with people of religious traditions other than your own. So the idea, as I put you to sleep, you'll be able to say, I've got better things to think about, and believe me, you do. So what I'm going to talk about actually today is a book. This will come at the end of the talk. This is Jacques Dupuy's book, Toward a Christian Theology of Religious Pluralism. That is the culmination of this man's life. He was born in Belgium in 1923. He died of a heart attack, the last of two or three, in Rome in 2003. Some people think that his diminishing health at that time was due to the stress of writing this book. There is quite a story behind it. But before we get there, what I would like to begin with is a statement that Jacques Dupuy, who is a Jesuit priest, he's a very eminent man, a statement that he refers to from a conference of Christian theologians and scholars in India in 1991. They were reflecting on their experience 25 years after the Second Vatican Council. And what they agreed on saying was that today, in a pluralistic society, to be religious is to be interreligious. And we're going to unpack that. In other words, what they were saying is, for us in India, we cannot simply define ourselves as Christian over against the great Vedic traditions in India, over against Islam, over against the Zoroastrian traditions, the Parsi traditions, or the traditions farther east in Buddhism, whether it's Mahayana or Vajrayana. But we have to recognize that in our own being, as human beings who are alive today, deeply committed to a religious path, we are interreligious. We are. And so something of what Farouk was saying is very seminal for us. I think we in this continent and coming from Europe, particularly we Christians who come out of a time of dominating the world in the era of colonialism, at least parts of it, we don't realize how small a factor we are compared to the great multiplicity of worldviews that there are. One tragic situation that we have is if we look at the First Nations people in Canada, we have a stellar example of how inhospitable we are, or we have been, to religious traditions other than our own. We are sitting on a piece of ground that was very dear to Aboriginal First Nations people, and Father Lacombe, as Dr. Downey said, was amazing in how he was able to become the man of the great heart, as they called him, because they learned to trust him. But regrettably, he is not the norm, but the exception to our situation. So today what I would like to do, I have a long text. I'm going to try to shorten it. But please don't lose contact with your experience of interreligious life. Not just dialogue. Not just dialogue. I think that has come across. We have to be changed by the encounter. When we leave this conference, we will all be changed. We will all think differently. Our pathway to God will have a different texture than before we arrived here. An essential question that confronts leaders and scholars of all Christian denominations today is how are we to understand God's purposes, given that the diversity of world religions is a fact of human existence? This issue does not preoccupy the adherents of most other religious traditions insofar as they adopt policies of live and let live. For example, the Vedic traditions of the East, which Western colonialists called Hinduism, celebrate a plurality of paths into sacred transcendence, while Buddhists offer their practices of mindfulness and compassion to all people without inviting them to change their religious allegiances. Observant Jews adhere to the Torah while asserting that Adonai will care for Gentiles in a providential manner. Muslims identify both Christians and Jews as fellow Muslims insofar as they submit their lives to God by practicing their respective forms of the Abrahamic tradition. In sum, the plurality of religions is a uniquely vital issue for Christianity in view of the missionary commitment of all denominations, namely to evangelize and convert to the gospel people of all religious traditions and no religious tradition. Among world religions, Christianity is distinctively gospel evangelical because it asserts the necessity of the grace of God in Jesus for the salvation of everyone. However, at least since the Second World War, various Christian denominations have had to re-examine the posture of Christianity vis-a-vis other world religions. I suggest the primary force which propelled this reorientation of Christians toward people of all other religions was the Shoah, the extermination of 6 million Jews by the German Third Reich between 1939 and 1945. The overwhelming passivity of the churches, both within and outside Germany, in the face of Hitler's final solution, forced Christians to acknowledge the roots of their inaction in the anti-Semitic tendencies of their traditions over the previous 1,500 years. Reconsideration of their dealings with Judaism also compelled churches to renew their interactions with Islam, the great traditions of the East, the Vedic traditions, Buddhism, Sikhism, Taoism, Shinto, and the Aboriginal traditions of Africa, Latin America, and North America. Reviewing the expulsion of Jews and Muslims from Spain by Christian monarchs in 1492 prompted a new outlook on the Spanish Inquisition, and the heritage of the Crusades to retake the Holy Land from Muslims beginning in 1096. Christians needed to face up to their enmity with Islam, which endured, though I respect Farik's point about the friendliness at certain points, but it endured for 1,200 years, this enmity. Moreover, the fact that 1492 is also synonymous with the journeys of Columbus to the Americas has forced Christian churches to acknowledge how they were often more the agents of colonialism than of Jesus, and in the people who came with Columbus often were responsible for genocides, the proportions of which they had not formally comprehended. The Roman Catholic Church began to come to terms with its past at the Second Vatican Council, which was convened on October 11, 1962, and concluded on December 8, 1965. This was the first ecumenical council in the history of the Church to demonstrate a favorable outlook on other Christian denominations and on the diverse religious traditions of the world. The revolutionary quality of Vatican II derived from its commitment to two central cultural movements: Ressourcement, a fresh investigation of Christian roots by reading primary texts in their original languages and cultural settings, seeking out the intentions of the original authors, and Aggiornamento, a reconceptualizing of Christian existence in relational reciprocity with the contemporary world through openness to modernity and conversation with people of all cultures. In this paper, I shall highlight how the renewed understanding of the Bible and world religions at Vatican II initiated a cultural dynamic that has made Catholics active participants in the interreligious engagement. I shall illustrate how contemporary biblical studies and the documents of Vatican II underline the necessity of learning from and collaborating with all religious traditions. Then I shall describe how biblical research and the tradition of Vatican II have propelled the articulation of a Christian theology of religious pluralism over the past half century, notably in the work of the Jesuit scholar Jacques Dupuis. What I'd like to do now is go through the renewal of biblical studies. I hope you will not find this redundant, but I think it's quite important for our conversation. At the Second Vatican Council, the Constitution on Divine Revelation was a turning point in the spirituality and self-understanding of Catholics. It describes revelation as God's self-disclosure through the communication of divine life to human beings. God, who is manifest through creation, mediates divine love to people in diverse ways, and most fully in Jesus. Faith, as the human response to this revelation, consists in opening one's being to the indwelling of God and the Spirit. And since revelation is the disclosure of divine love, faith must be lived out in community as a manifestation of God's love in the world. For Christians, this community originates in the church, but it extends outward to include people of all cultures and traditions, whether or not they profess explicit belief in God. De Verbum describes sacred tradition as the handing on of divine revelation. This tradition consists not only in the passing on of truths, but more profoundly in the handing on of ways of living in the Spirit of God. And the normative standard for sacred tradition are the Old and New Testaments. So what I'd like to do is invite you to consider the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible right now, in terms that the Vatican Council invited biblical scholars, I'm in that heritage, to read these texts, looking for what the original author and audience intended. What I want to say is this, that the Bible, reading the Bible, should open one's mind rather than close it. In the process of examining the original meaning of sacred texts, the historical critical method casts light on traditions behind the texts. We recognize that biblical texts and the biblical understanding of God derive from interactions between Israel and various cultures of the ancient Near East. And please just remember this word. In other words, the Bible itself is the product of interreligious engagement. A historical overview of the biblical era indicates the breadth of cultures that contributed to the worldview of the Hebrew Bible. In the 3rd millennium BCE, Sumer, Akkad, and Egypt. In the 2nd millennium, ancient Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, the Hittite Empire, and Phoenicia. In the 1st millennium, Egypt, the Neo-Assyrian and Neo-Babylonian empires, and subsequently the empires of Persia, Greece, and Rome. A brief survey of biblical text illustrates the cosmopolitan nature of the Bible. The Babylonian creation story in Numa Elish informed the creation story at the beginning of the Bible. Hittite and Neo-Assyrian suzerainty treaties were the template for presenting the covenant at Mount Sinai and the template for the book of Deuteronomy. An Israelite scribe inserted an adaptation of the 11th century BCE Egyptian text, the instruction of Amenhotep, into the book of Proverbs. Israel developed her understanding of God by interacting with surrounding cultures. The Israelites identified Adonai with the high god of the Canaanite pantheon, El, and the presentation of Adonai as the storm god reflects the Canaanite god, Baal. Moreover, Asherah, the Canaanite goddess and consort of El, apparently mutated into personified wisdom, which is Adonai's advisor in the book of Proverbs. The New Testament, for its part, presents Christianity as a tradition that derives from Judaism in the first century. Jesus of Nazareth was a thoroughly Jewish apocalyptic prophet who announced the kingdom of God in his words and demonstrated its inauguration in his deeds. He declared the kingdom would come to full realization under the aegis of the Son of Man, who would bring about the end of the present age shortly after his death. The apostolic witness to his post-resurrection appearances identified Jesus with that Son of Man. Paul kept alive this apocalyptic consciousness by asserting that the age to come had begun with the resurrection of Christ and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. What I want to say, for instance, is I would suggest that the letters of Paul belong in the category of Hellenistic Jewish literature. Paul did not see himself as a founder of a new religion, but as a reformer of Judaism. What I want to just conclude with is this, that any time a Christian reads the New Testament, they're in dialogue with Judaism. And by being in dialogue with Judaism, they're in dialogue through the Hebrew Bible with the whole world of the ancient Near East. And that brings us to the point of the talk we just heard. We cannot know the God of the Bible without knowing the world of the ancient Near East, not just the world of Israel over against those cultures. We cannot know Christianity without seeing it as a reinterpretation of all of that literature in light of Jesus, but presented then to the world of the Mediterranean basin. Now, how many minutes have I got left? Okay, I'm going to keep talking fast. You can have a snooze. Okay, we'll give it a try. We'll look at Vatican II on world religions. I summarize the perspective on world religions at Vatican II by focusing on three themes. First, conscience as the sanctuary of God in every person according to the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world, Gaudium et Spes. Second, the Catholicity of the Church, according to the dogmatic constitution on the Church, Lumen Gentium. And finally, the depiction of various religions in the Declaration on the Relation of the Church to Non-Christian Religions in Nostra Aetate. Let me begin here, because this is a key point. If you wanted to open up the discussion on how Catholics begin where they found their discussion on interreligious activities. The pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world was unprecedented insofar as the bishops addressed it not to the church hierarchy or even the laity, but to the whole of humankind. The document opens with an expression of the solidarity that the church experiences with every person, particularly the poor and the afflicted. The first chapter leads the reader to contemplate the human person from the outside inward, beginning with an enhanced understanding of the body, moving to an appreciation of the faculties of intellect and will, and finally to concentrate on the conscience. The description of the endpoint is evocative. Here it is. Conscience is the most secret core and the sanctuary of the human person. There, she or he is alone with God, whose voice echoes in the depths. The council identifies the conscience as the faculty that enlightens everyone about how to live a virtuous life. The distinctions between believer and non-believer are secondary to the basic tenet that every person has God's law inscribed on his or her heart. The council goes on to assert that human dignity consists in freely adhering to the dictates of one's own conscience. Here's the quote. Human dignity, therefore, requires everyone to act out of conscious and free choice, as moved and drawn in a personal way from within, and not by their own blind impulses or by external constraint. You can only do good by acting freely from inside your own being. Those are the stipulations. Now, that is what provides the basis for the revolutionary decree at Vatican II on religious liberty. Everyone has to have freedom of religion. And it also, the sacredness of one's conscience is essential to the validation of all religious traditions, insofar as every religion expresses the highest aspirations of a community towards self-transcendence, realized in loving community, loving union with the ultimate mystery and with humankind. Now, let's turn to the church. The dogmatic constitution on the church describes the church insofar as it reflects the presence of Christ as, quote, a sacrament, a sign and an instrument of this, communion with God and the unity of the whole human race. Paul VI, the Pope, at the end of the council said this, more than once, the church is not an end, it is a means. The church is not a perfect society walled off over and against all other people. It is a servant. to bring all people into communion of life with God by loving service and everybody being free of their own ego to care for everybody else. That's what it is. Now, a primary mark of the church is Catholicity or universality. The universal church includes not only the churches in communion with Rome, but also all churches by virtue of their adherence to the gospel. The council extends the discussion of Catholicity to a consideration of how the great religions of the world are related to the Christian church. Foremost among these are the monotheistic traditions, Judaism and Islam, which share with Christianity allegiance to God's covenant with Abraham. Judaism maintains primacy in the divine economy, and the document concentrates on two Pauline principles. These were very important after the Second World War. First, the church, in view of, I will say it, you can debate it, 1,500 years of anti-Semitism, had to say this. And here's what it said. The Jews are the direct descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whom God called in the beginning, and God will never withdraw the divine favor bestowed on them in the beginning. Furthermore, according to Lumen Gentium, God's salvific plan does not end with Christianity, but extends to Islam. Since Muslims take Abraham as their model in faith, practice submission to the only God, identify mercy as the primary divine attribute, and orient their lives towards God's final judgment. Now, in the document on non-Christian religions, what is treated in relationship to the church there is presented in terms of the invitation to dialogue and conversation with all traditions. One of the things that is very pronounced there in that document is the church's commitment to repent of the past and to say we must heal the wounds. And the way that it expresses this is it treats the traditions from the ones that are most least offended by Christianity, at least from our perspective, namely Hinduism, Buddhism. But then it focuses on Islam and finally on Judaism, because those last two become very, very serious in the historical situation that Vatican II was trying to address. Now, the dialogue, as you see, has to continue. I have 6 minutes. So what I want to do is go to Jacques Dupuy. Jacques Dupuy is a man who taught in India from 1948 to 1984 in Jesuit faculties of theology. When he moved to Rome, he became the editor of Gregorianum, the main publication in theology at the Gregorian University. He taught a course at the Greg on Christianity in relationship to all religions. And he was an advisor to the Pontifical Commission on World Non-Christian Religions. By the way, a good friend of mine ran that commission, Michael Fitzgerald. He's the apostolic delegate in Egypt now. But what Jacques Dupuy said is this, that as we have looked at Vatican II in the heritage, we're now almost 50 years later, we have to realize that we cannot stop at dialogue. We have to recognize that the practices and the texts of non-Christian religion are resources that Christian theologians have to study, because from them they will learn the breadth of the divine economy. The premise is that the revelation of God is not confined to Christianity. There are many religions. There are all the cultures. God is greater than any one particular tradition. We all have to have humility. Otherwise, we end up being tyrants. Our way or the highway. Now, what Dupree says is once we become involved in this and we see that this is the pathway into the absolute, we go on this premise. None of us can enter into the presence of God without all of us doing so. That's a very important principle. We can only be well together. We are only as close to God as the person who is most alienated from us. That's the very simple issue of solidarity. When God redeems humankind. God does not redeem in a sectarian piecemeal fashion. And what Jacques Dupuy is advocating, is that spiritually, being changed by the witness of people of religious traditions that are very different from us is very important for us because it helps us to appreciate the otherness of God from who we are at the present moment. And so he sets out a very, very serious discussion. It's not saying all religions are the same. To the contrary, it's saying they have to be very different. It's not to say all of them have the same idea of the absolute. No. But it is to say we cannot be well unless we are informed and changed by the grace, the goodness, the holiness, the love of people in all traditions that are other than our own. And so that's why I want to conclude by really thanking David Goa for inviting you here. And I thank you for coming because you are going to be in the memory of St. Mary's University College from this point forward and help us to be faithful to what we are about. Thank you.